From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. Small businesses are the backbone of the American economy. There are more than 33 million small businesses operating in the U.S., employing more than 61 million Americans, according to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. A new white paper from UNLV's Center for Business and Economic Research, or CBER, shows that Nevada experienced a significant rise in small business creation during and after the COVID-19 pandemic. While the state endured some of the nation's deepest job losses in 2020 due to its tourism-dependent economy, the disruption sparked an entrepreneurship boom that continues to redefine Nevada's economic landscape. To learn more, I spoke to CBER Director Andrew Woods. Andrew, welcome back to State of Nevada.
Hey, Paul. Thanks for having me on.
Let's talk about this paper's findings that more than 40% of all businesses operating in Nevada were created post-pandemic. What was it about the post-pandemic era that was special for entrepreneurship?
Well, it was a very unique event. We didn't see the same type of spike in small businesses after the Great Recession or previous recessions. What seemed to have occurred is given the mixture of government policy and stimulus, as well as the fact that we had a lot of time on our hands. We all remember being indoors and not being able to socialize and go out as much as we had in the past. And those combination of things seem to have really sparked entrepreneurship here in Nevada, but also across the country. I mean, these findings are not only in Nevada. I think what we were interested in is what was the magnitude in Nevada, which was significant to the point where it was the third fastest, or we were the third fastest growing in small business creation with employees behind Delaware and Wyoming after the pandemic. So the magnitude was very much significant here in Nevada. But again, that mixture of de-risking and time seems to have really sparked that entrepreneurial spirit here in Nevada. And again, it was like, I don't think this would occur again if we have hopefully not another recession, but it was a unique moment in time. And then what we were trying to learn from the paper is, did those businesses continue on after the pandemic? So was this just a one-time kind of spike and then you get back into the normal business cycle and these businesses fade away? You know, as we know, many small businesses, the majority of small businesses don't survive past a few years, but it seems to be the case up until 2024, which was the latest data that we have available. Many of these businesses are still operating today.
So what kind of small businesses started?
Yeah, great question. So if we segmented this into employer businesses, so businesses that had employed someone other than the owner. And then the other segment was just businesses that was just the owner, the sole proprietor. The ones that were not employers, so just the sole proprietor, there was a lot in transportation and warehousing, which we went back to a lot of the food delivery, Uber, Lyft driver, this kind of gig economy work. Interesting, though, among employer firms, we saw a lot in professional and business services. So this is like lawyers, accountants, engineering firms. There seems to have been a lot of growth in Nevada on those professional services side, as well as healthcare was a big one, real estate, other services, which is the category when we can't categorize anything else and we put it in. So there was more growth in these areas, especially was good to kind of note here. These are areas that the state has really tried to diversify into beyond just leisure and hospitality. And so seeing that the businesses that were actually employing people and the ones that, you know, were created after the pandemic were in these key areas that we've talked about for decades of growing, well, it actually occurred during the pandemic.
Do we know who opened these businesses?
One, we found a greater amount of women opening and operating small businesses during the pandemic, more than men. It's still primarily men who own and operate small businesses, but there was a greater share of women opening and operating small businesses. That continues to you know, as of 2024, when we last have data. And then the other one was the Hispanic community. We found that they too were more likely to own and operate a business or start a business after the pandemic compared to before. So we can speculate why that may be. Some ideas is that they were those groups were heavily hit by the pandemic in terms of being laid off or having a hard time finding work. So you kind of force people into having to take on entrepreneurship and start a business to make ends meet. Again, a lot of these policies in place were spread out widely, meaning through the banks, through associations, through government. So they might've had access to those resources to be able to start their business or grow their business potentially, or again, just being forced to kind of think about what it would be like to be a small business. But so far, the preliminary results show women and Hispanics were a large contributor to the growth since the pandemic, and you know, accounting again for now the fact that 40% of all our businesses in the state of Nevada are small businesses, and the growth for employment after the pandemic in small business accounted for about 45% of all employees. So these are women and minority-owned businesses that not only started business but employed people in the state of Nevada.
Are there any policies, either state or local, that would help extend the trend?
I would say that the policies that help create and then sustain these businesses since the pandemic probably are not sustainable, because it was a lot of de-risking. Basically, firms couldn't fail during the COVID pandemic. So we de-risked your ability to start and own a business for at least a year or two there. And then you had a really surge of consumer demand, which has helped uplift many of these businesses and kept them going despite higher prices, higher wage costs, et cetera. I think going forward from a policy standpoint, you know, again, figuring out what are their champions. I think what in economics we hope to happen is a few of these businesses really turn into really big businesses. So they go from just a handful of employees that maybe a decade from now they're employing thousands of people. So figuring out where does the state or the local community really have a vision of what kind of businesses they want to see there, that they can then put some nudges in place to support those businesses without necessarily having to subsidize the whole thing, as we saw during the pandemic, that made it de-risk, you know, that ability to start and own and operate a business for a little bit. Because again, we want these businesses to be able to stand on their own 2 feet and grow and be successful. But and so like an area that example of that is, I think, healthcare. We know we need more healthcare in this state. We need more people to be entrepreneurial in that space, as well as for workers to move into that space. So figuring out what are kind of the small things that government and you know, chambers and associations can do to nudge those along or make sure that they can have the opportunity to be successful with, say, new business development and continue to grow and grow into bigger businesses. And one thing too, Paul, that was really interesting about this is in terms of the businesses that were adding employees too, it wasn't necessarily the mom and pop 1 in 5 businesses, even though that was the majority of businesses created with employees. It was the businesses that had 20 to 99 employees. And again, those were in these specific areas I mentioned earlier. So professional and business services, professional scientific and technical services, healthcare, areas that, again, we've really focused on. Those businesses now exist in Nevada or moved to Nevada during the pandemic. And the question is, do they then go from that middle range of small business to something much larger? And how do we then build an ecosystem that allows for that?
I know there's a lot of economic data showing that the U.S. economy is still growing, but the average consumer would tell you that the economy is sluggish at best and that the price of most necessities are starting to slip out of reach. Are you at all concerned that that attitude may impact small business owners?
I'll give you the typical economist argument. So I'm going to give you on one hand and then on the other. So on one hand, yeah, I think the between tariffs and now potentially spiking oil inflation, we also know that labor costs have gone up. When we poll businesses, right, finding qualified employees seems to be a limiting factor. There's a lot of pinch points for small businesses out there across the United States, here in Nevada, in Washoe County, in Clark County, in the rurals, across the state. There are pinch points that are always making, you know, harder to own and operate a small business. I would argue those things are always there. What makes a small business successful or not, so there's the other hand, is that they are very rugged. They are very quick and nimble and able to pivot when needed. If they are, you know, as long as they're thinking like that, they can move more quickly and be more dynamic. And we saw that we had a period of very high inflation. We had a period where labor force costs went up or was a struggle to find a labor force during this period. And our initial thinking was you would have seen then a large spike in closures of small businesses after the pandemic in that period in 22, 23, 24. But that's not the case. So again, a lot of these businesses still continued on because I think they're very thrifty and scrappy in terms of how they deal with those challenges. And that's part of being a small business owner, is that you have to be thrifty, scrappy, have a lot of grit, and it's never easy. Every day you're trying to balance your books. So I the economy is never perfect. So I think, you know, the ones that continue to roll up their sleeves and figure out ways to balance the books and run a successful business are going to be just fine no matter what the economic environment is out there. But I agree that as an economist, I certainly do worry about where consumers are right now. I worry where the economy is right now and where are we going forward. But they don't call it a dismal science for nothing. We're always worried.
Well, let's try to end on a positive note. Ultimately, what do you think this report tells us?
Yeah, so I think this just goes to show that Nevada is a much more sophisticated economy than we give ourselves credit for. The reason why we did this paper, or started this paper, which by the way, Paul, we've been working on for 4 years, because we saw the initial headlines about Nevada being one of the best places for a startup. And I was like, well, how true is that? Let's quantify that. Let's test this hypothesis. Did this actually occur in the state? And we were really pleased to see that, yes, not only occurred, but again, another hypothesis was, well, they probably all, you know, shut down or closed up after a year or two. And it's like, no, they continued on and they were operating in 2024. So I think just for us, it's shown that the state is a lot more dynamic than we give ourselves credit for. We definitely want to go back in a few years and look back and say, did they continue on even further? That this spike we saw had a long kind of effect, tailwind to it after the COVID that continued well on to the Nevada economy and continued to help grow our economy, despite all the challenges out there, that this has a long-term effect on our economy. So we're very curious to see that in the long term. But so far, you know, very positive results that surprised us. Again, we're economists. We try to be realistic and skeptical, and we were surprised and pleased and optimistic given everything that we saw over the last couple of years.
Andrew Woods is the director of the Center for Business and Economic Research at UNLV. Andrew, thank you.
Thanks, Paul.
Of course, you can learn more about that small business report at our website, knpr.org. Tax Day, April 15th, is less than a month away. So if you're like me, now is the time when you're scrambling to find every piece of financial paperwork you need to file your taxes. About two-thirds of tax filers will get a refund. Of course, others will likely have to pay. But even in the last month before the tax deadline, people are still mulling over what forms to fill out and how their tax filings may have changed due to the passage of last year's One Big Beautiful Bill Act. Here with me to share their insights are two tax experts. Todd Cox is a Las Vegas-based CPA, and Francine Lippman is a professor who teaches tax law at the William S. Boyd School of Law at UNLV. Todd, Francine, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Good morning. Happy to be here.
Francine, I want to start with you. As I mentioned, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act passed last year means lots of changes to the tax code. One of the biggest seems to be no taxes on tips or overtime. You know, simply, how does that work?
Well, it's interesting. And by the way, tax people call the One Big Beautiful Bill Act OBA. So that's what I'm going to be calling it. These new provisions in the tax codes are actually deductions. And so that perhaps is a little bit surprising to people, because when we think of no tax on something, we think that it's just excluded. But here, the devil is in the details. And so in order to benefit from these provisions, you have to first report the income. And so that's going to be hopefully on your W-2. For the hospitality industry, which as we know is quite robust in Nevada, they're going to have tips on their W-2, and then perhaps an overtime column as well. The 2025 tax filing is going to be incredibly complicated because employers are not required to separately report your overtime. So that's going to add another wrench in tax season.
Are all these tips and overtime work now exempt, or are there exceptions? Is there a cap on this tips and overtime rule?
Yes. So, and again, there's complexity there. For tips, the deduction, and again, it's a deduction, not an exclusion. So that means you have to first report the tips. For people who are not self-reporting their tips, they don't get the deduction. So the deduction is up to $25,000. And that's complicated too, because it's $25,000 whether you're single or married filing jointly. And so two tip workers who decided to get married in 2025 are perhaps going to be penalized by this.
Lots to consider there. Todd, I want to bring you in. Let's talk about business taxes for a second. Do businesses have to file their tax returns this time of year as well?
No, they had to file them on Monday. So most of them had to file Monday. The S corporations and the partnership returns are due on March 15th. Since March 15th was Sunday this year, it was due Monday, the 16th. But yeah, so they're always a month before the personal. But except for the regular C corporations, they are the only exception to that rule. But yeah, they got that extra deadline up that cuts them at the knees there. So.
Well, the reason I ask is because there's lots of folks nowadays who are acting as independent contractors, self-entrepreneurs. You know, they get a lot of money from things like Venmo, Cash App, Airbnb, Etsy, whatever it is.
Oh yeah.
You know, is that income treated differently
Well,
than, say, business income?
like Professor Lippman mentioned, like the devil's in the details on this stuff too. If you're filing your business as a Schedule C on your personal tax return as a sole proprietor, then that information, that tax return is due. That schedule will be due with your tax return on April 15th. But if you've been industrious and you're making good money and you determine that forming an S corporation to kind of shield some of your taxes, some of your income from payroll taxes and some other things. Well, then you could put it in an S corporation, and that tax return would be due Monday.
What sort of paperwork would somebody need if they're doing that sort of work?
Well, a lot of times, you know, if say you're doing rideshare, you're doing like DoorDash or something like that, you know, the food delivery apps. They'll give you a 1099 that often you need to go into your portal and get it downloaded to get it immediately. And then you need to any normal, regular, or necessary business expense that's logically attached to your business is you know, a slam dunk deduction against that income. If you made $10,000 in your enterprise and, you know, by doing rideshare or delivery or any other business really, but and you've got like your expenses to deduct against that, and those are like $3,000. Well, then you only have to pay tax on the 7,000. You don't have to pay tax on the full 10. So you need to
Gotcha.
calculate your deductions, make sure you've got them in line, and you know, anything again necessary and ordinary, but also. So necessary doesn't always have to include ordinary, right? So that's kind of the nuance there.
April 15th, tax day is just 4 short weeks away. That means it's crunch time for those of us who've not yet filed our taxes. Maybe you owe a little and you're looking to hold off filing until the last minute. Maybe you're scrounging for every last deduction you can find. Well, we have two experts here to help guide you. Professor Francine Lippman teaches tax law at UNLV's William S. Boyd School of Law. Todd Cox is a Las Vegas-based CPA who owns his own firm, Todd Cox CPA. Francine, so far we've talked mostly about income, but let's switch gears and focus on expenses for a minute, specifically medical expenses. Is it worth tallying up every cent on medical expenses if it's less than, say, a couple grand?
So the quick answer is no. And by the way, the standard deduction amounts under OBA have increased. And so those amounts, I'm going to run some numbers by you now. A single person, the standard deduction amount is $15,750. Married filing joint is double that, so it's almost $32,000. If you're head of household, meaning you're unmarried with a qualifying dependent in the household, the dollar amount is closer to $24,000. Bottom line here, Paul, more than 90% of all taxpayers use the standard deduction amount. As for medical expenses, there are significant cutbacks on those, meaning that you don't get dollar one. You don't start getting a deduction until your aggregate medical expenses exceed 7.5% of your adjusted gross income. Bottom line, Paul, I've been doing this longer than many of my students have been alive, and it is rare and unusual I see someone who deducts medical expenses. And sadly, as I teach my students, the individuals who do, it is typically a super senior citizen whose spouse is toward the end of their life cycle. And what they're doing is they're paying extreme medical expenses out of savings. And so their income is really low. So medical expenses and including charitable deductions. And I hate to tell listeners, but their home mortgage interest expense and the wonderful property taxes that we pay to the state of Nevada. More than 90% do not get a tax benefit from those because they use the standard deduction.
So you've actually beat me to my next question, but when is it better to use the standard deduction versus itemizing?
Bottom line is, if the standard deduction amount is higher, so it's just a comparison. And for most Nevadans, we don't have a state income tax. Interest rates have been relatively low, and our housing again is relatively low. And so your home mortgage interest expense and our property taxes are generally capped and they are generally low. So most Nevadans are not going to be itemizing their deductions.
Todd, talk to me about one thing I'm particularly happy about, and that is the car loan interest deduction that I, from my understanding, got passed in OBA. How much of an impact could that have on someone's tax return?
So the car loan interest is only eligible for new cars that are purchased during the tax year, and that's only eligible for cars that are manufactured in the United States. They have to have a end manufacturer in the United States. And so I haven't had one come through my office yet where that was eligible, but my understanding is it's they come with the form from the dealership, and you're going to have the actual VIN number and everything in order for it to be eligible. And the interest you pay on that car is the deductible portion. So if it's not the purchase price, it's the car. But if you buy that car for a business or something, the new depreciation rules that they've made permanent that were from the prior the 2017 bill, those will now be permanent. One thing that I did want to say about the charitable deductions is there's a new provision that even if you use the standard deduction, if you contribute up to $1,000 of charitable contributions, like to Nevada Public Radio or to another charity, that is still eligible for a deduction in addition to your standard deduction. So that's something that listeners can keep in mind, that if they contribute. Go ahead.
Go ahead,
Not
Francine, please.
till 2026, right?
Yes. It's coming in. Yes. But yes, that's something that coming. So that's this year. That's right now. So don't do it for last year, but for this year going forward, that's a new option that people can use. So.
There is a deduction, a temporary expanded senior tax deduction that was incorporated for this one year as well, for last year, I should say. That was seen as a way to perhaps bolster the economy a little bit. Francine, what is going on there?
So, actually, the reason for that deduction from our political debates was to shelter Social Security, right? And so there was a lot of discussion, no tax on tips, no tax on overtime, and if you remember, no tax on Social Security. Well, none of these deductions really do that. I mean, they provide some relief from the taxation of tips, overtime, and Social Security, but they're really not tied to it directly. And so this new deduction for seniors, it is for seniors, and when I say senior, that means 65 and older, who, and it has nothing to do with your Social Security, as you may or may not know, you don't have to claim Social Security until you are 70. After that, it doesn't increase anymore, so you should claim it then. And you can claim Social Security as early as 62. And so even if you don't claim Social Security, this is a benefit for 65 and older. It's an additional $6,000, and it's in addition to your standard deduction amounts, Paul, that are even enhanced for seniors. So grandma and grandpa should be pretty happy with the deductions this year. That $6,000 does phase out for at a pretty low threshold, $75,000 for individuals, double that for married filing joint. So it benefits individuals really regardless of collecting Social Security or not.
Yeah.
What about tax relief for young families? It appears that Congress did approve an increase for the child tax care credit. Am I reading that right,
You
Todd?
are.
Oh, Francie, go ahead.
Yeah.
Yeah, you are. So the child tax credit, which has really been a safety net for working families with kids, is now for 2025. And after 2025, it's going to be indexed for inflation. But 2025, it's $2,200 per qualifying child. And that's a credit. So a credit, Paul, is more powerful than a deduction because a credit reduces your tax liability dollar for dollar. However, as we all know in Nevada and beyond, $2,200 is really not a cost benefit on having more children. So, but it does help working families with kids.
Todd, anything like to add?
No, I think $2,200, obviously it's not gonna pay for everything, but it does blunt the expense a little bit there, and it is a big benefit. It phases out when the kids turn 17, so the year your child's 17, it's gonna drop to 500, and it's not a credit anymore. It's just a deduction. So you got to kind of be braced for that. When that year they go into they're a senior in high school, it's like, hey, brace yourself because you might have a little bit of a step up in your refund, or step down in your refund, or a little bit of a tax owed. So,
we've got a few minutes left, Todd. What are some common mistakes folks make when they're preparing their taxes? What do you see over and over again?
Well, it's just a matter of understanding the tax code and knowing your specific circumstances. There's a lot of nuance in the business tax preparation. Getting your accounting right, getting your deductions right. One of the biggest things that I see with people is they don't consider the deductions that they're eligible for in their business, or they fail to track them adequately. Get your mileage right. Make sure that you're tracking your mileage if you've got a business that involves that. Make sure that you're, your phone and the internet expense and any of those subscriptions that you have, that kind of stuff is a deduction for any of those small businesses that we've been talking about, like from the first segment that Professor Woods was talking about. And then, we've got there's if you prepare it yourself and you just kind of muddle your way through it, or I've had people come to me and be like, well, I went through the tax the questions in the self-preparation software, and I knew it was wrong, but I didn't know how to change my answer to make it right. And so it's like, yeah, just bring it to a professional so that you're not floundering in the last day there and trying to get it in. So
Francine, we got about 40 seconds left. Where would somebody go if they're looking for a cheaper way to file their taxes?
So first of all, don't procrastinate. The great news is for low-income taxpayers, and that means 80, 89,000 of income or less, There is free assistance. It's called Nevada Free Taxes. They have a website and they provide free assistance throughout Clark County. In addition, the IRS website has free online software. So access it, and it's question and answer. Use free resources first before you go to a paid professional if you qualify. And don't procrastinate.
We're going to have to leave it there. Professor
Yeah.
Francine Lippman teaches tax law at UNLV's Boyd School of Law. Todd Cox is a Las Vegas-based CPA who owns his own firm, Todd Cox CPA. Professor Francine Lippman, Todd Cox, thanks for chatting with me. Las Vegas iconography gets celebrated by local artists all the time. And typically it comes from the Strip, maybe Fremont Street. But Ethan Salmon wanted to shine a spotlight on another Las Vegas. The ones locals drive by on their way home. The one that doesn't always look glamorous. The one that shows what nature eventually does to an urban environment. The born and raised Nevada artist and Las Vegas Academy instructional assistant has done just that. His current exhibition, Structured, is showing through March 28th at Recycled Propaganda, where he also serves as the de facto gallerist. KNPR's Mike Privat spoke to him last week. Here's that chat.
Ethan, welcome to State of Nevada.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here. So how did Structured, the exhibition, begin?
Structured began as a dream of preserving Vegas. There's a lot of different places and locations throughout the city that I've always held dear to my heart, both through the aesthetics that are presented as well as the way that memories are connected to different places. And I wanted to create an art show that spoke towards the preservation of memory of different locations throughout the city.
You know, I wanted to ask you about Las Vegas history. It's kind of a loaded topic. Invariably, erasure comes up, myth-making comes up. And I'm wondering, are you addressing what's often missing when we talk about history in Las Vegas?
So, yeah, I think a lot of the presentation of Vegas history focuses mainly on the Strip and on Fremont Street and on these cultural centers of the city where the main industry of Vegas came to light, that being gambling, the nightlife, all of that sort of thing. But I wanted to really focus more on the off-the-beaten-path corners of the city, all different locations that truly the locals will identify with more than anybody else.
This exhibit does feel very much like a local's view of Las Vegas. You have the Anderson Dairy emblem. You've got the Davies Locker sculpture. You've got Fong's garden sign represented there. You do include some classic Vegas iconography. You've got Vegas Vic and Vegas Vicky in the corner. What were you trying to say by including them?
If you want to talk about different mascots that stand for, you know, different properties and different eras of Vegas, I think Vic and Vicky are perhaps the most recognizable couple. And I just knew I had to have them in the show.
I know that on your Instagram, I think one of the works dated back to 2 years ago when it was finished. Do you have a sense of how long it all took, or you were working on these before you even knew you had an exhibit? Was maybe that the case?
That's right, yeah. So I've been really getting into these sculptures and models for about the last 3 or 4 years. Been creating art really as long as I can remember. Been an artist since a young little kid. And a lot of the pieces did exist before I even knew that I was planning this show. And that comes from my surroundings, really. I'm extremely inspired by my surroundings and just these different places that I grew up going around, the daily drive by the Korean barbecue place or the bike rides past Vic and Vicky on Fremont Street. I just wanted to memorialize those places.
You know, the gallerist part of your
Sure.
artistic personality really serves this exhibition because you walk in and it's not just art on white walls and sculptures on floor pedestals. On your Instagram account, you actually have this time-lapse reel that shows how you transformed that room to make it feel like the room itself was an aging sculpture showing off all these other aging sculptures. And at the risk of using an overused term, it actually felt immersive. And I'm wondering, how did you decide to basically make art out of the space itself?
Thank you, first of all. That was my goal with the show. I wanted it to be immersive. I've always appreciated immersive art and all kinds of spaces where people and artists transform a space to feel completely different. You can step in and step into a different world. I've been incredibly inspired by lots of different local artists that have done this before. And I really wanted to create a space that reflected the work presented. A lot of my models feature industrial infrastructure and rust and grime and oil stains. And I wanted the space of the gallery itself to reflect that. And I wanted viewers to be able to step in there and almost feel a part of one of the models that they see in front of them.
Can you attribute your interest in things that are degrading, the grime, the grit, the things you just discussed? Where do you trace that back to?
I've always been fascinated by the way nature takes back over, the way that there's erosion and Mother Nature changes things over time.
You know, you're rendering a lot of former and surviving physical attributes of the valley. We're talking buildings and signs, also mountains, and you're doing it all in a very particular way. Did you want to say anything specific about the city with what you chose to represent and how you represented it?
I feel I should give some backstory to why I appreciate all of these places so much and why it features so much of downtown Las Vegas. And that's because I've grown up there. I've grown up in the John S. Park neighborhood, and it's my daily walks and my bike rides and my driving to school that I see all of these places. And, you know, I've always been surrounded by these cultural landmarks that harken back to these different eras of Vegas that I never got to experience. As a 22-year-old, I've only ever known one version of Vegas, and I've always looked back at these historic photographs and different motel signs and locations throughout the city that harken back to the past. And I've always been just intrigued by the aesthetics.
You know, I found a short bio for you on one of your previous exhibitions, and the bio read that the act of creation has always served Ethan as sort of a therapeutic release. He uses art as a tool to work through life's challenges and to express his ideas that can't be verbalized through words. Do you feel like structured served that purpose for you as well?
100%. Even though the artwork featured in my show isn't very conceptual, it's like what I would like to say nonfiction artwork. I didn't have to make many creative decisions, or, you know, I didn't have to come up with these emotional ideas. Even though the artwork itself is not emotional, I still find a lot of emotional catharsis through the act of creation and just the act of sitting down, zenning out, carving away at a block of foam with an X-Acto through those moments of silence and practice, I guess. You know, you end up working out a lot of stuff in your mind. You're able to bake a lot of what you got going on in your head into a piece of paper or a sculpture or whatever it is.
So it's fair to say Structured is a fairly personal exhibition.
It is. I'm a fifth generation Las Vegan. So these are places that my own family and ancestors worked at or even owned back in the day. In the front window of the exhibit, I have a huge painting that features different properties that my great-grandpa owned back in the day. Ray Salmon, he was partners with J.K. Housels back in the day and owned the El Cortez for a few years in the 40s. Mm. And Anderson Dairy Man, I have generations of family that worked at Anderson Dairy. We were all over town, and those sort of connections are really important to me. And I try to do that justice through the art that I create.
So I want to talk about the creation of this art for a second. This show features paintings, sculptures, models, all your work. It makes me wonder, how do you determine whether to, say, paint a whole building on a canvas or create this very intricate scale model?
Sure. Yeah, it has a lot to do with what I just feel like at the time. I tend to work on a lot of artworks at once. Sometimes I'll have in my studio two sculptures going, and I couldn't possibly sacrifice another square foot to do another sculpture. So I'll put a painting up on the wall and get started on that instead while all the sculpture's off to the side. It really just comes down to also what I see fit for that particular building. There might be a motel sign that I might not have faith in myself having the capabilities to fabricate. For certain projects, it might be more efficient and economical for me to try to paint it instead of build it as a sculpture. And vice versa.
Mm.
For example, I have a piece on the Mission Linen building in my show. And that building is just so detailed. It has, you know, all of these electrical conduits, and it's got the electrical substation next door to it that I included. There's no way I could possibly just put all that detail into a painting. I really wanted to spend the time of making each of those little elements, making it 3D to do that amount of detail justice.
So, Ethan, I'd be remiss not to mention Recycle Propaganda itself. That is the name of the gallery. It is going to be 8 years old this year. It's also the pseudonym of artist Isaac Zavalking, and he's known for his social commentary in his work. And the gallery itself is known for its expression of current affairs. How do you think that structured fits in to that ethos?
It focuses on a local issue, while Recycled Propaganda tends to focus on a broader, more national and even global approach to commentating on, you know, what's going on. He speaks towards what's going on in the world and in our country, in our state. And he does make, you know, local artwork as well. But my show in particular really focuses on the Las Vegas level of what's going on.
Structured is up at Recycled Propaganda Gallery in the Arts District until March 28th. Ethan Salmon is a principal staff member there, and he is the creator of the exhibition Structured. Ethan, it's been great speaking with you today.
Thank you so much for having me.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Back with us to talk about a few of the best options is KNPR's Mike Privat, who oversees the Arts and Culture Beat for Nevada Public Radio. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
We're just coming off the Oscars. Aside from catching up on some of the winners, how else can people keep that movie-watching mood going?
So to set this first event up, it's worth noting that in a very male-dominated industry, women took home Oscar trophies for 11 out of the 20 non-gendered competitive awards last Sunday. It's especially worth noting that two women UNLV alumni worked on two Oscar-nominated projects this year. Berenice Chavez was an editor on Come See Me in the Good Light, which was a nominee for Best Documentary Feature. And then Tamia Nadine was an assistant art director for The Singer, which actually won for Best Live Action Short Film.
All during Women's History Month, no less.
Right, which means, naturally, the must-attend event for the week is the 12th Annual Nevada Women's Film Festival at UNLV. That takes place from March 19th to the 22nd. And over those 4 days, you've got about 72 films from 15 different countries, and they're all by and or about women. 9 of those official selections were directed by people associated with UNLV. And as with most film festivals, there will be panel discussions, and there are other events like award ceremonies and mixers to round it out. You can get an all-festival pass, or you can get individual block tickets. We'll have a link for all of that info at KNPR.org.
Sounds like a good time for the movie buffs out there. All right, Mike, what is a water lantern, and why is there a festival devoted to it happening in the middle of the desert?
So a water lantern is basically, you've got a base, you've got a four-sided screen, shall we say, that fits around the perimeter of that base. You put it out in water, it floats. You have a candle usually in the middle. Sometimes there's things written on the screen, and we'll get to that in a second. And basically, the reason why they're having a festival for it, I kind of point to the Rise Lantern festivals that have been happening in Southern Nevada over the past decade. Now, there's a similar concept with the Water and Lantern Festival. Like Rise, there will be some performers and speakers at this March 21st event at Craig Ranch Regional Park in North Las Vegas. And, of course, the core activity of these gatherings, which is sending lanterns off as a way of personal release or expression, and, of course, in this case, sending the lanterns off into the water.
I've always wondered, what happens to all of that stuff?
Well, I wondered the same, and the event staff on the website says that they gather all of the lanterns and all the waste after the event to leave no trace. Now, speaking of leave no trace, the obvious other question is, why do folks do this? I have never been to a lantern festival. I've never been to Rise. I've never been to a water and lantern festival, nothing. But I've seen the concept at work a little bit. The last time I attended Burning Man, I went to their temple. This is the structure that's burned a day after the big, large burn that the event is named after. And throughout the week, folks go visit the temple, and they typically write down affirmations, confessions, regrets, resolutions, remembrances, you know, anything meaningful to them and anything they might want to manifest. And it can be very moving to look at. So accordingly, attendees of the Water and Lantern event can write down or draw whatever their hearts desire on their lantern before they send it out. And again, ticket info for that event is at knpr.org. I'll say this final note. I think this does have the potential to be perhaps the most soothing large event ever in Southern Nevada.
I think a lot of folks out there need to take a moment to slow down for more meditative practices. Finally, a trigger warning for those of you who don't even want to hear about spiders, but Mike is forcing us to talk about it anyway. Mike, what's going on?
You know, I saw this event come into my inbox today, and I knew that we had to mention it, despite the fact that it's open all the way till August 23rd. For all 8 of you arachnophiles out there, or maybe just for you families looking for a good excuse to visit or revisit this place, the Las Vegas Science and Natural History Museum is debuting a new summer exhibit, and it's called The Art and Science of Arachnids, and it's the biggest touring exhibit devoted to our 8-legged friends. And you look at the list of the displays and the activities, it really runs the gamut of anything that you could do involving arachnids. They're going to talk about the history and the science of them, to the cultural relevance. They're going to have spider-inspired art and sculptures.
Really? Spider sculptures?
Not only that, the press release described them as larger than life. The event also promises an immersive exhibit, Paul, and hands-on activities, and drumroll, the live arachnid encounters assisted by trained educators.
Nope, absolutely not. Nope.
You know, I've seen and experienced this firsthand. Kids love this kind of up-close access, especially with animals that they normally find pretty creepy. So I can imagine all the fears that one could overcome all at once. And by the way, Paul, arachnids are not just spiders. Scorpions are also part of the arachnid fam.
You know you're really selling this, right? All right, that's all the time we have for this week. Thank you, Mike.
Thanks, Paul.